This is the Everything Financial Radio program. I'm your host, Dennis Tubergen. Glad you decided to tune in this week. I have a great show lined up for you. Joining me just momentarily will be Ellen Brown. Ellen is the author of a couple books, one titled Web of Debt, the other titled The Public Bank Solution. We're going to talk to Ellen about the state of the U.S. banking system and ask her, should you be concerned? And also joining me on today's program, Mr. Harry Dent, best-selling author. I will be getting Harry's forecast for the markets moving ahead. Before I get to those conversations, let me remind you of a couple resources we have available for you here in West Michigan. The first is an absolutely free resource. It is a Social Security maximization workshop. In light of the new Social Security collection rules that were put in place back in November, we're sharing with you how these rules might affect you. If you're between the ages of 55 and 65, you'll find the information that we discuss at this meeting very helpful. You can get more information by visiting the website socialsecuritydinner.com. The website socialsecuritydinner.com will be at Boulder Creek Golf Club on March 29, out at Sunnybrook in Granville on April the 14th, and at Noto's Old World Italian Restaurant on April the 19th. Again, to get more information or register, visit socialsecuritydinner.com. Also, our new retirement rules class is taking place on April the 23rd. I've had a couple of near-capacity classes already this year. You can get more information at newretirementrules.com. The website, again, to get more information on the new retirement rules class is newretirementrules.com. I'm pleased to have back on the Everything Financial Radio program Ellen Brown. Ellen's website is ellenbrown.com. I would encourage you to check it out. She is a prolific researcher and writer. Her books, Web of Debt and The Public Bank Solution, are important reads as well. And Ellen, welcome back to the program.
Well, thanks, Dennis.
Ellen, let me just jump in for our listeners maybe that did not catch the last interview that you did here on the Everything Financial Radio program. Talk to the listeners about the current state of the U.S. banking system, in your view.
Today, virtually all money is created by banks when they make loans. And so in the U.S., like in the entire Western world, and you could argue most of the world, everybody is in debt. Governments are all hopelessly in debt, and it's because of the way money comes into existence. So that's what I write about, is the fact that historically, actually for thousands of years, if you want to go back to the Sumerians, there's been this war between publicly issued money, which is where most people think money comes from. You know, dollars and coins have pictures of presidents on them and look like they're issued by the government. But in fact, that's only a very small percentage of the money supply, and the dollars are issued by the Federal Reserve, which is not the Treasury, and which lends them to the Treasury like it lends them to everybody else. And virtually all of the money is created by banks. So they create it as a loan, which means they always, you know, require more payment back than they put out there. So there's always this great great gap between the amount of money available to pay the loans and the amount that's due on the loans. I mean, some people argue that it's possible to pay the whole thing by because of the velocity of money. In other words, you can because you pay every month, the creditor, if the creditor pays the money back into the system, it's available to pay month after month, and that's technically, arguably, hypothetically true, but it's just not the way it works. There's all kinds of glitches in the system. People don't spend their money, they save it. The creditors put it into offshore bank accounts, or they re-lend it instead of actually spending it on goods and services where it gets into the pockets of consumers. So governments and people and corporations are all in debt just because of the nature of our money system. So that's what I write about, and that's how we could get out of it, is to reform the whole monetary system.
So, Ellen, to stay on that topic for a moment, I've had a number of guests here on the program that have forecast that we will see banking failures moving ahead that'll be reminiscent of what we saw back in 2007 and 2008. Would you agree with that particular argument?
It's certainly, the banks are certainly in trouble, but there's this huge black budget issue, according to Catherine Austin Fitz, who was assistant secretary of HUD under the first President Bush. She says there's something like $40 trillion in the black budget. It seems to me, since all markets these days are manipulated, they could arguably manipulate their way out of it like they have before, or they, whoever they is, could intentionally crash the system as they have before. So, not being an insider, I can't really say, but if it were an ordinary capitalist free market, yes, the banks would go down again, especially because of this whole derivative scheme, which has grown to unbelievable proportions.
Well, I want to visit that derivatives subject here in just a minute, but you'd said something in that they could intentionally crash the system as they have before. That, I'm sure some listeners thought, why would they intentionally crash the system? So why would they do that? And can you give us an example of that, Ellen?
Okay, well, maybe I overspoke. Let's say, as they may have done before, and it looks highly suspicious, there is an argument to be made that in 2008, Lehman Brothers could have been saved, like all those other banks were, but they intentionally, or they did let Lehman Brothers go down. There was an offer to buy it over the weekend when Lehman Brothers went, basically declared bankruptcy, but it was too late. The government sort of dallied, and anyway, it didn't happen. So there was no purchase of Lehman Brothers. It went down, and that established this whole model of too big to fail, that was a big disaster. We can't let the big banks go down, and therefore we have to bail them out. So now we have this sort of mixed socialist, in other words, the banks get the benefits of a socialist system, but they also get to keep the profits in a private system. So it's socialism for the rich and capitalism for the rest of us. So then in the spring of 2009, that's when the G20 met they met in London supposedly to resolve this issue. And that's when the Financial Stability Board was made official. And this was a board that previously it evolved from a previous entity, which was just advisory. But the Financial Stability Board was actually mandatory. Like, if you're in the G20 and you accept its oversight, then you're supposed to do what it says. And it was very big at the time, the G20. They had authority over 12 different things that were just very broad, and you could interpret them. I wrote about it at the time, that you could imagine that it would give them total control over everybody's monetary system. And then we saw that happen in 2010. We had the Financial Stability Board came out with the whole resolution scheme, which is commonly called the bail-in scheme, where big banks, in order to save themselves, and because at that point governments had gotten tired of bailing out the banks and basically weren't willing to do it anymore, now the big banks were being told that it was legal and that they should actually confiscate the money of their creditors in order to maintain their solvency, and that the largest class of creditor is the depositors. So basically, it's now legal for banks to steal our deposits if they're in trouble. And then you can see all kinds of things stemming from that. But arguably, this was the plan in 2008 to crash the system and therefore make everybody terrified and willing to bail out these banks, which you would never have seen that before. I mean, the whole idea that the Federal Reserve could buy an insurance company, they effectively bought AIG, and bail out these huge banks and turn Goldman Sachs into a bank that got to have FDIC, basically got, the privileges of a depository bank. it just never would have happened except for this crisis that could have been prevented, but wasn't.
Well, our guest today is Ellen Brown. Ellen's website is ellenbrown.com. She is the author of the books Web of Debt and the Public Bank Solution. And I'll be continuing my conversation with Ellen when Everything Financial Radio returns. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Everything Financial Radio program. I'm your host, Dennis Tubergen. Let me remind you that if you're not yet a subscriber to my weekly Portfolio Watch newsletter, it is free. It's delivered by email every Monday at 5 p.m. All you have to do to subscribe is visit the website, yourportfoliowatch.com, and sign up. The website, again, yourportfoliowatch.com. I have the privilege of chatting today with Ellen Brown. If you're just joining us, Ellen's website is ellenbrown.com. She is the author of the books Web of Debt, as well as The Public Bank Solution. And Ellen, I want to go back and just pick up at the beginning of this segment where we left off at the end of the last segment. You had mentioned that bail-ins are now legal, and bail-ins, to paraphrase, allow really a bank to confiscate the money of depositors. We've seen that happen in Cyprus and, I guess, Ukraine and Greece to some extent. You can correct me if I'm wrong. But now, are you saying that that is potentially possible here in the United States?
It's not just possible. It's actually in the Dodd-Frank Act. That's what those too big to fail banks are supposed to do if they get in trouble. It probably won't happen soon, but it certainly could, and that's why you can be nervous about having your money in the big banks. But then you can be nervous about having your money in any bank, since they all are part of the same system, and they do overnight sweeps, and you know it's pretty hard to see where to put your money now. And plus the fact that we're tending more and more to go all digital, and any digital money, by definition, is somewhere in a bank. Well, I guess it could be in a stockbroker, but anyway, it's somewhere else. It's not in your safe.
So, Ellen, when you say overnight sweeps, I think that's a term a lot of listeners have heard, but they might not be familiar with exactly what that means. Could you explain?
Banks all, well, I'll start with how banks create money. They create, let's say you go to the bank to take out a mortgage, and it's a $500,000 mortgage. The bank will write it on one side of their books as a liability to themselves, and on the other side as an asset to themselves, because you're going to pay them back. But when you, so their books balance. Now, when you pay the seller of your house, and that check goes into another bank, suddenly the first bank is going to be $500,000 short. But they can borrow that money back from the second bank, which now has $500,000 excess. So the way they do that is overnight, if you got some excess, then you put it out there in the Fed funds market where other banks can borrow it. And they just borrow it overnight, and they do this over and over and over. There are these short-term repo sort of deals where, I mean, it's all this big ruse. The money is all somewhere in the system, and all you have to do is hunt it down, and you can borrow it for 0.25%. But this, or now it's like 0.35%. But this is money that is created by the banks themselves, and then it goes somewhere else, and then they borrow it back. So overnight, you know, the big banks, if they're going to go bankrupt, it'll be overnight or over a weekend. It always is. You open up the news in the morning and you find out that somebody went bankrupt. So your money might be in some Wall Street. Even if you put your money in a small local bank, it might have gone to a Wall Street bank overnight, and that might be the last you see of it.
Well, Ellen, you mentioned derivatives in the last segment. So again, in the interest of explaining today's Banking 101, explain to the listeners, what are derivatives? And the second part of that question would be, why has it gotten to be such a big problem?
Derivatives theoretically protect against risk, and they do protect. Every derivative has a bank on one. side of the trade, and so and typically on both sides of the trade. So they're basically protection against risk among the big banks. But overall, they've totally destabilized. I mean, it makes it riskier for everybody else if you're not in that system. And so a derivative is basically a bet. It's sold as a form of insurance. Like, let's say you're worried that interest rates might go up and you have a variable interest rate. It's sold to cities and school districts and so forth on their loans when they get variable loans. The big banks that make the loans sort of push these derivatives on them and say, you'll need to protect your interest rate with this derivative that'll keep you, if the interest rate goes up, then we, the bank, on the other side of this bet, will pick up the difference. But the catch is that if the interest rate goes down, that party that's allegedly, the party buying the insurance, what's alleged to be insurance, has to pay the bank. So you've got all these cities that got suckered into these derivatives, and then the interest rate plunged. And why? Because the Federal Reserve intentionally dropped it very, very low to help out the banks. So the Fed, which is the head of the banking system, the private banking system, is obviously working for the banks, and they get to, so you're not buying insurance like against an earthquake or some random act of God that nobody can predict. You're buying insurance against an act of the central bank, which is the House. So the House controls the bet. And now derivatives are growing. It depends on who you read, but I think the official number is over a quadrillion.
A quadrillion dollars is completely unfathomable, and you have to think that if that's the level of derivative exposure, that certainly big issues with the banking system have to be imminent at some point. Is that a fair conclusion to come to, Ellen?
You would certainly think so. I mean, it's amazing that it hasn't collapsed already. But I think that's one of the things where they manipulate it behind the scenes. I have a theory on, you know, how oil plunged. And it was after Secretary of State John Kerry went to Saudi Arabia and negotiated something, we don't know what. But anyway, after that, the oil price plunged. And allegedly, I mean, the theory is that it was to get Russia and get Iran, who are totally dependent on their oil profits. And then you might say, well, it also gets the frackers. But the frackers are independent, you know, businesses that are also competitors of the big oil companies, and it's the big oil companies that are linked to the big banks. But anyway, funnily enough, when the other big banks were cutting back on their derivatives, Citibank was in there buying these derivatives against, you know, oil derivatives, hedges against the oil price going down, I think. So you could, maybe arguably, you could envision that John Kerry said, well, we know that you're going to lose some money on this, but don't worry, all you have to do, and we can't just pay you with the difference because that'll be too obvious, so we're going to launder the money through this derivative scheme. You just buy, you know, we'll be the party on the other side of the bet. That's the other thing. Derivatives are totally dark. You don't know who the party is on the other side of the bet. So nobody can trace it. If it was the government hedging the bets of Saudi Arabia in order to get them to participate in this scheme. I mean, that I don't know. Of course, I don't know that that's true. But it's a possibility. That's what you can do with derivatives. And so they could be manipulating markets all over the place to prop up things that look like they should have collapsed a long time ago.
We're going to have to leave it there. Our guest today on the program has been Ellen Brown. As I close this segment, let me remind you to stay tuned. In the next segment, I'll be talking to best-selling author Harry Dent and get his latest forecast for all markets. We'll talk to him about stocks, bonds, gold, as well as commodities. Harry has been a frequent guest here on the program, and I know you'll enjoy my conversation with him. And a quick reminder also, if you have not yet attended our New Retirement Rules class, you can get more information by visiting the website newretirementrules.com. We have a class coming up on April the 23rd. Again, the website, newretirementrules.com. Welcome back to the Everything Financial Radio program. I'm your host, Dennis Tubergen. Joining me just momentarily will be best-selling author Harry Dent. Let me remind you that we do have some free workshops in the Grand Rapids area regarding how you collect Social Security benefits. There were some new Social Security collection rules put in place in November. Many folks are not aware of how these new rules might affect the way they can collect Social Security. So we are offering some free workshops for you to come and learn all about it. The workshops begin at 6 p.m. They conclude at 7:30 p.m., and we serve a complimentary dinner as well. We have three workshops coming up, March 29 at Boulder Creek, April 14 at Sunnybrook, April 19 at Noto's Old World Italian Restaurant. More information is available at socialsecuritydinner.com. You can also register at that website as well. I'm pleased to have as a returning guest on the Everything Financial Radio program, Mr. Harry Dent. Harry is a best-selling author, economist, and the premier demographic researcher in the country. And Harry's newsletter, his free newsletter titled Economy and Markets, is available at harrydent.com. Also, an updated copy of his book, The Demographic Cliff, is available at the same website, harrydent.com, for free. You pay just $4.95 shipping and handling. I'd encourage you to check both of those resources out. And Harry, welcome back to the program.
Yeah, nice to be back, Dennis.
Harry, give me your assessment of what's going on in the economy. It seems that slow growth is now again dominating the headlines.
Yeah, you know it is, and it's kind of funny. I mean, even not just slow growth around the world, China's much slower than they're saying, because their exports just got reported down 25% year over year. How could their economy possibly be growing at the 6.8% they're claiming with exports, which is, you know, 35% of their economy, you know, down that much? So China's slowing. Europe's having to, you know, Draghi just had to pull out the bazooka again today because growth is slow there. Italy's banks are in shambles. Germany, Deutsche Bank, just had a $7 billion loss from bad loans, and they've got huge exposure to the frackers in the United States, to Italian businesses. And they've got more derivative exposure than even J.P. Morgan, the top one in the United States. So all this stuff happened. We're also looking at, like, the restaurant index I just saw a couple weeks ago. It went slightly negative, you know, below 100, which means, you know, they're flat to contracting. And restaurants should benefit more than anybody from low gas prices. And we're seeing jobs, you know, when we look at the payroll taxes taken by the government instead of the stupid non-farm payroll reports that are, number one, always overstated and revised later when nobody cares, and they make tons of assumptions and estimates. This is real hit. This is what all businesses are withholding from the paychecks of their employees. That has been showing a market decline in payrolls in the first 2 months of the year. So everything does seem to point to slowing. The only thing I see that's not does not seem to be slowing is that home sales seem to be going up in the first few months of this year, but everything else seems to be slowing, especially globally. And the markets just, you know, as usual, kind of ignore it. But especially an 18, the biggest thing to me, 18% drop in the earnings of S&P 500 companies since September of 2014 and to the end of 2015, 18% drop, and the stock market is still trying to go up. And at that 18% drop, the price-earnings ratios, instead of the 15 to 16 to 18 that people keep throwing out on CNBC and stuff, it's 23 times price-earnings ratio, which is, you know, clearly in dangerously overvalued territory. So, I keep telling people, I think, you know, we got a rebound in here after having our first substantial correction or two. I don't think this rebound is going to last past the next couple of weeks. If that, it may already be over. And then I think you're going to see a deeper drop. Stocks are going to have to come to reality with a slowing U.S. and especially a slowing global economy. The other thing I'll say before I let you get back in is just, I'm telling you, Europe is going to have a major problem by the end of this year. Italy is the next Greece, and Greece is going to have more problems. And Cyprus, I did an interview with a radio show in Cyprus, and this lady's a prominent small business person. She says, we never recovered from that bail-in when they just took deposits from people like her and Russian oligarchs and foreign depositors. That economy's never even come close to recovering. So you got big problems coming in Europe by the end of the year.
Harry, you mentioned the high levels of derivative exposure around the world. Is it your view that another banking system failure to some extent is imminent?
Yeah, I mean, I just put out in my newsletter recently that bank stocks, I'm talking major banks around the world, U.S., European, et cetera, they're diving. I mean, Deutsche Bank's down 59% in less than a year. It's down 89% from its top in 2008. UniCredit, the largest bank in Italy, is down 91% from its top and 58% recently. Banks are starting to go down because of bad loans, especially in Europe, and concerns about derivative exposure. There's still $550 trillion, so it's not billion, trillion dollars of derivatives in the world. You know, that's like 7 or 8 times total global GDP. And the people on Wall Street always say, oh, this is no big deal because, you know, they kind of balance out between the people who guarantee these loans and the people who, you know, get the insurance. But the problem is the people who are guaranteeing these loans, these credit default swaps, and that's what they are, they're insurance against loans or bonds defaulting, yet they have no collateral. It's just speculation, and it's done on high leverage. So the problem, like we saw with Lehman Brothers, and that's why the recent quote was, is Deutsche Bank the next Lehman Brothers? When these things come due and somebody's over-speculated and has lost money, they don't have the money to come through, and so they do collapse, and it's highly leveraged. So derivatives are a huge thing, and again, Wall Street just like, oh, it's okay, and you know, everybody's like, everything's going to be okay because the Fed and central banks aren't going to let the economy slow. Well, they're running out of ammo. They're going to negative rates now, which is a sign of utter desperation. Negative rates have not worked anywhere near as well as QE, quantitative easing. And even quantitative easing. I mean, if quantitative easing was doing so well, how come Japan's back in a recession after tripling down in early 2013? And how come Draghi has to come in, add more stimulus and more negative rates when they've been pumping like crazy? It just doesn't work at some point.
So, Harry, you mentioned negative interest rates. And, yeah, Europe's had negative interest rates for a couple years or so. Japan now has negative interest rates. What's the end game here? I mean, at what point do central bankers just throw in the towel and say, look, none of this stuff is working?
They will never, ever, 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 ever throw in the towel because they cannot. They pumped this bubble up so far, even farther than before when it was naturally bursting in 2007 to 2008. They have no other card to play. If they stop this stimulus, this thing will melt down. There's not even a question about that. That's why the markets every day want to know somebody else is increasing their quantitative easing. Somebody's going more negative. They have to do this. They will do this until it utterly fails. And when it utterly fails, it means we're going to have a worse crisis than we would have had if we'd have just let the market sort it out back in 2008 and 2009. We'd have been over this darn thing by now.
So, Harry, what does this worst crisis look like, and how will our listeners be affected in your view?
Well, you know, first of all, I think it cascades around the world as usual. I think, you know, Europe is the biggest problem right now. China is right on the heels of that. I mean, China, everybody thinks the government has things under control there. Well, how come they couldn't stop their exports from dropping 25%? I mean, that's incredible. They've been doing everything to stimulate, and it hasn't been working. And I tell you, ultimately, the last place to go where the best house in a bad neighborhood will be the U.S. I think this whole divisiveness in politics is a sign of things to come. I think when the world goes into the next crisis, we're going to have we think we got polarized politics now. Wait until the economy fails worse than 2008 and 2009 and see how angry people are. And you know, who knows, you know, what happens with Trump and Sanders and all. And they still are two likely candidates. I'm not convinced. Everybody's convinced Hillary's got this thing locked down. I'm not convinced because I think when the economy gets worse later this year, it's going to favor the outliers like Trump and Sanders. So imagine you got those two guys. One of those two guys is in or not, and the world goes down. I think you're going to have the most polarized politics. I think you literally could have some degree of just civil unrest, people just saying, I can't take it anymore sort of things. And unlike Europe and Australia and other countries, developed countries, we got 300 million guns. So it's I think people need to get serious about just saying, look, I got to protect my capital, number one. Hey, if you want to take some risk and bet on some stuff going down, everything from gold to stocks and real estate and things, fine. But the number one thing is to protect your money. Get out of this bubble before it bursts, because bubbles burst violently and rapidly when they finally do. And, you know where you live and all these things are going to make a difference. So, you know, just kind of gear up here for a difficult couple of years. I think 2016 and 17 is going to be the worst of this. I think it's going to the next crash is going to last that long. And then we're going to be off and on in difficulties and debt deleveraging and you know, kind of like in the 30s until at least 2022. So this, you know, I hate to bring bad news, but we've had the greatest boom in history, and I was one of the biggest forecasters of that. And now great booms turn to bust, especially when governments go into denial like this and say, we just won't let debt deleverage. I'm like, Dennis, why can't governments and central banks just tell banks and their shareholders and their bondholders, you got to take the hits? Why do we have to keep, you know, bloating these banks and not forcing them to write down loans and pouring money into the banks through quantitative easing and pushing interest rates to zero short and long term when you adjust for inflation, perverting the economy, you know, just encouraging endless speculation and greater bubbles, and bubbles only burst. Nobody can keep a bubble going forever, just like nobody can keep an orgasm going forever. And I've got my next book's going to show they are the same thing. There's not a whiff of difference between an orgasm and a financial bubble. They look just alike, and they burst dramatically. They don't correct, they burst. So this is what we're looking at, and since most people haven't seen a bubble in their life, as the last one happened in the roaring 20s and burst in the early 30s, nobody understands this, and nobody gets it. And the trick in asset allocation for most financial advisors is not going to protect you at all, because it did not in 2008 and 2009. And the reason it didn't is because everything went down. When everything goes down, except maybe the highest quality bonds or cash or the U.S. dollar, when everything goes down, what good is asset allocation? So you have to get out of the way. It's that simple. And it's a once-in-a-lifetime thing. Nobody's going to see it coming except a few people like you and me and the people listening, hopefully. And the people who do see it coming and get out of the way, they're going to see the sale of a lifetime on financial assets. I tell people, if you'd have bought anything at random, just thrown darts at real estate, stocks, businesses, anything in 32 to 33 when that crash was bottoming, you would have made money for decades and decades for the rest of your life, and you'd still be way ahead even after this next crash. There's no better time to make kind of extreme wealth long term than to get cash out of a bubble near the top and rebuy the best assets, whatever you're interested in, vacation, real estate, homes, you know, businesses, stocks, you know, Coca-Cola, Google, buy them when they're down 70, 80, 90 cents on the dollar, because that's what happens when bubbles burst. They don't correct 40 to 50% like normal long-term bear markets like in the 70s, like in the 30s. Bubbles burst 70, 80, 90%. We've already seen it in Japan. 80% was the low for the stock market, and they're probably going lower than that. Real estate down in Japan wasn't down 10, 20, 30. It's down 60%. It's never bounced 26 years later. So that's what we're looking at.
Well, our guest today is Mr. Harry Dent. We will continue our conversation with Harry Dent when Everything Financial Radio returns. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Everything Financial Radio program. I'm Dennis Tubergen, your host. If you're not yet a subscriber to my Portfolio Watch newsletter, I would invite you to get a free subscription by visiting the website yourportfoliowatch.com. Each week, I give you my commentary as to what's going on in the markets and the economy, as well as my forecast moving ahead. We have thousands of subscribers. I would invite you to become one of them. To sign up, just visit the website, yourportfoliowatch.com. The website, again, your, Y-O-U-R, portfoliowatch.com. I'm pleased to be chatting today with returning guest, Mr. Harry Dent. Harry is a best-selling author. His most recent book is titled The Demographic Cliff. He's offering it to our listeners today for free. All you have to do is cover shipping and handling of $4.95. You can go to harrydent.com and request the book. You can also sign up for Harry's free newsletter, Economy and Markets, at that website as well. So, Harry, I think in the last segment, it's fair to say that you're bearish on stocks. How low do stocks go?
My best forecast, and this is one of the clearest patterns you can see, and nobody's looking at it because they're in denial, called the megaphone pattern. The Dow, has each bubble has taken us to new highs, 2000, 2007, and then 2015, and this does look like a top already. But each crash in between has taken us to new lows. So each high gets higher, each low gets lower. That simple projection would say, by sometime around mid to late 2017, the Dow should fall to something like 5,500 to 6,000. So nobody's expecting that, but every time you stimulate, you're going to expect a bigger crash because you've overstimulated. So this should not be a surprise. It's common sense, but that's my projection for the Dow. That means on the S&P 500, probably be about 500, and it was at 2135 at the top. It's 1993 right now. Real estate's probably going to end up down 50 to 60% from the top back in 2005 to 6, not the 34% we saw. And so after the rebound, that could be a 40 to 50% drop on average. And imagine how big it'll be in Manhattan, where they're selling condos at $5,000 to $10,000 a square foot, when $2,000 a square foot used to seem to be a bubble. In Miami, you know, in San Francisco, in LA, in Vancouver, and all, you know, the most bubbly cities. So, and, you know, we've said for a long time, oil's going to end up between $8 and $20, and it's already hit $26 recently, and people thought that was impossible. Oh, OPEC will never let that happen is what I keep hearing. Gold's going to go to $700 by sometime in 2017, roughly, and I think ultimately down the road it'll bottom closer to $400, maybe a little lower. So, I mean, this is what happens. The general rule in a bubble is that you go back to where the bubble started. For real estate, the best way to gauge that, the bubble started in the U.S. and in most countries, January of 2000. That's when things took off and started going exponentially, exactly when stocks started to crash and everybody started to run into real estate. So look at your property, and that's your downside risk, and maybe a little lower than that. And stock bubbles and commodity bubbles and things like gold and stuff, 80% is the best assumption. 70 to 90, but that in most of my forecasts end up down about 80%, including my stock forecast down the road, because I think stocks will eventually end up 3,800, give or take. And that's because that's where the bubble started in late 94. So, I mean, it's grim, and this only happens once in a lifetime. And we get major extended corrections like the 1970s and the 30s twice in a lifetime, which is once in a generation, every 35 to 40 years. But this kind of bubble economy and this debt deleveraging and bubbles bursting, that is once in a lifetime. Last time it happened was the early 30s. So, again, anybody thinking, oh, we're just going to have a 10, 20% correction here, or even somebody who's pretty darn bearish, I hear people saying, well, yeah, it might be 40, 50% given all the imbalances. Nope, you really got to assume more like 60 to 90%, unfortunately.
So here we've got about a minute and a half left. The Fed is going to try probably everything they can to pump up asset prices. What makes you believe they can't be successful?
Well, that is one of the problems the Fed has. I mean, Europe's been escalating stimulus, so there's no problem for Mario Draghi to say, okay, I'm going to add another $20 billion a month, and I'm going to make interest rates even more negative. The U.S. reversed that policy. So it's much harder for them to change course. They will at some point. Don't worry about that. The economy gets bad enough. But the problem is monetary stimulus takes a lag to hit. And so if the Fed waits until maybe this summer when it's more obvious that the economy's going in recession instead of escape velocity, which is the biggest dream I've ever heard of, then the Fed will start to go back to QE, but I think they're going to be late. And I think Larry Summers and some other prominent figures who are calling for more stimulus are saying the Fed's going to be late. So I think they're just going to be late, and things are going to start falling apart so fast. I mean, I tell people that the problem is, what does Draghi do or Janet Yellen at the Fed if the China real estate bubble bursts? That will send shockwaves throughout the emerging world and the developed world, because all the leading edge markets from Manhattan to San Francisco to Vancouver to London to Singapore to Sydney, Australia, all the most overvalued markets are being driven by affluent Chinese laundering their money out of their country. So there's nothing the central banks here can do to stop that. And so I think at some point it just starts falling apart. Humpty Dumpty falls off the wall, and they figure out, God, we just can't put him back together fast enough. That's what I see happen. But they will try to stimulate. You will see QE4.
Well, we're going to have to leave it there. Our guest today has been Mr. Harry Dent, best-selling author. You can get a free copy of his book, The Demographic Cliff, by paying shipping and handling. All you have to do is go to harrydent.com. And, Harry, thank you for joining us today.
Okay. Thank you, Dennis.
Well, and in case you're just joining us here at the end of the program, let me remind you of some resources we have available here in the West Michigan area. First, we have our new retirement rules class coming up on April the 23rd. That is a Saturday. The class begins at 9 a.m. and concludes at 2:30 p.m. There is a cost for the class. It is $49. That covers the cost of you and a guest. We serve lunch. That cost also includes lunch. You get all the handouts and the new revised version of the new retirement rules book, all for just $49. You can go to the website, newretirementrules.com, to register or to get more information. We talked to you in this class about where we believe assets might be headed. We talk about where you should put your money, in our view, in light of these predictable economic and money cycles that we believe exist. It is a unique perspective, and one that you, we believe, won't find anywhere else, and also an important perspective. So again, to get more information or to register for the class, visit newretirementrules.com. And also, we have some Social Security maximization workshops coming up here in the West Michigan area, March 29 at Boulder Creek Golf Club, April 14 at Sunnybrook Country Club, that's in Granville, and April 19 at Noto's Old World Italian Restaurant. Visit socialsecuritydinner.com to get more information or to register. The website again, socialsecuritydinner.com. And you know, if you'd like to listen to the Everything Financial Radio program anytime you'd like, the show is produced in podcast form each week. Just go to the iTunes store and search under Everything Financial Radio, or visit the website, everythingfinancialradio.com. That's all the time I have for this week. Hope you got something you can use on this week's program. We'll talk again next week. Bye.